No one likes bad news. I hope you enjoy this little story as much as I do. It concerns a bagpipe player from Newfoundland. I like to say in out there, the Big Rock, a Newfie Piper, they called him. I hope that's okay. The story's told in the first person, so I'll use the piper's words as he tells of his experience. As a young piper, I was asked by a funeral director to play at a graveside service for a homeless man who had no family or friends. The funeral was to be held at a cemetery way back in the country, and this man would be the first to be laid to rest in this particular cemetery. As I was not familiar with the backwoods area, I became thoroughly lost. And being a typical man, did not stop for directions. I finally arrived an hour late. I saw the backhoe and the crew who were eating their lunch, but the hearse was nowhere in sight. I apologized to the workers for my tardiness and stepped to the side of the open grave where I saw the vault lid was already in place. I assured the workers I would not hold them up for too long, but this was the proper thing to do. So the workers gathered around, still eating their lunch, and I played out my heart and soul. As I played, the workers began to weep. I played and played like I'd never played before. I played "My Home" and "The Lord is My Shepherd" and "Flowers of the Forest." I closed the lengthy session with "Amazing Grace" and walked to my car. As I was opening the door and taking off my coat, I heard one of the workers saying to another, "Lardy, lardy, boys, I've never seen nothing like that before, and I've been putting in septic tanks for 20 years. It's a great story. You don't have to be a Newfie Piper to find yourself making embarrassing assumptions. How often have we walked into a certain situation, examined the observable information before us, and say to ourselves, "Who are they? What are they doing?" And immediately, our brains fill in the holes of our information. Now, making assumptions can be behind all kinds of problems that plague mankind. We know that. Stereotypes against certain cultures and religions and skin types and ethnicity are all really based on assumptions. I happen to be very well experienced in the sting of stereotyping. And it's not because of my age or that I'm a white male or that I'm Canadian. It's because I'm a Baptist minister. Truthfully, thanks to television preachers and historical experiences some have had with preachers, or because of what a friend of a friend has said about a Baptist preacher, I meet people all the time who expect me to be a certain way. It reminds me of a cute little incident that occurred on a bus, where a lady leaned over to her seatmate and said, "Are you a preacher?" To which the man replied, "No, madam, I've just been sick for a few days." One of the greatest compliments I ever receive is when I'm getting to know people and we're really enjoying each other's company. And then I observe their responses when they finally learn that I'm a Baptist minister. It's wonderful to see how atypical I am in their minds of what they think a preacher is supposed to be. Assumptions, we all make assumptions. We make them all the time. Much to our embarrassment, and most frequently, our assumptions come out of what? Our ignorance. Our gospel lesson today is about assumptions, and actually, it comes in a whole section of the Gospel of Mark that deals with assumptions. The passage read today occurs immediately after Jesus inquires of his disciples, "Who do people say I am?" In other words, what's the rumor? What's the gossip about me? And the responses from the disciples was that some people, well, they thought Jesus was John the Baptist, Others thought him to be sort of a reincarnation, if you like, of Elijah, or maybe he was one of the other prophets. You see, the public had been listening, they've been watching Jesus, and they were trying to make sense of who he was, trying to fill in the gaps of their understanding. No matter how much information the crowd obtained about Jesus and his ministry, they still had more questions than answers to try and get an accurate picture of just who he was. But what about the disciples? They, after all, had been the ones who were closest to Jesus. They had heard and seen things the crowds were not privileged to observe. Who do they say Jesus is? Peter speaks, at least for himself. It's always Peter, isn't it? I believe, though, he was sharing a consensus. You are the Messiah. Way to go, Peter. The Holy Spirit has revealed a great truth to you. However, this revelation as Jesus being the Messiah opens up a whole truckload of assumptions. And the greatest of those assumptions has to do with what the nature of being the Messiah is. Peter and the other disciples may have determined that Jesus was the Messiah, but they certainly didn't understand what that meant, what it entailed. We know from other places in the scriptures that the disciples and others saw Jesus coming to humankind as a political or military in nature and full of earthly glory. Time and time again, the 12 struggled to understand Jesus' aversion to seeking attention, to perform miracles on demand, and his resistance to calling for an all-out military strike against Rome. Instead of picking up a sword, Jesus picked up a little child. Instead of demanding personal glory, he washed his disciples' feet. Instead of explaining a path to being served in his kingdom, he explained how it was more important to be the one serving. No wonder these disciples were so confused. We would like to look at the experience and think, gee, how could they be so dense? However, let's not forget that we're looking back at that experience. Hindsight is always 20/20, we like to say. I'm almost certain that if we had been among the 12, we would have been just as confused. And maybe we're still confused today about the nature of Jesus being the Messiah. All this unsettling confusion about the nature of Jesus, and then we walk headlong into today's passage, and we are absolutely shaken to the core, or we should be. Not only are many of the assumptions about Jesus wrong, but then he states that being the Messiah means he will ultimately suffer and he will die. The destiny of the Messiah, the suffering servant on Isaiah 53, is to be tried, humiliated, and crucified in Jerusalem. According to Jesus, the Messiah must suffer to accomplish his mission. The way of the Messiah is the way of the cross. And to follow him is to follow him to the cross. The suffering nature of discipleship is at the very core of the Gospel of Mark. Unless we understand that in following Jesus, we are walking straight into the way of the cross, we are just as dense as those disciples. The suffering nature of Jesus' mission, the suffering nature of being his followers, was not something the disciples wanted to hear. I don't think we want to hear it either. I used to have a dear friend and neighbor who lived in the condo building we lived in for a while in Scarborough, who had a little grandson at the time who was, well, what's the word? He was very precocious. One day she was babysitting her little preschooler grandson when she wanted him to do something. The little boy was very annoyed, and with a great scowl on his face and a hand raised with his palm towards his grandmother, he said in broken English, "No takami." After hearing that story, whenever I met her in the condo, I would tease her about something she said with "no takami." Well, whenever Jesus mentions his impending death, the disciples were just as determined not to hear it as that little boy. "No takami, Jesus." This whole idea of a suffering Messiah went against every assumption they had about what the Messiah was and why the Messiah had come. And it also broke every idea they had about what following him meant personally. Every time Jesus predicts his suffering and his death, the disciples fail to grasp it. Actually, they understood it. They just didn't want to hear it. Sometimes they just outright rejected it. In our passage today, Peter tries to rebuke Jesus for even suggesting such a thing. In chapter 9, verse 32 and following, the disciples did not understand, and they were afraid to ask for clarification when Jesus predicted his death, and instead they went on to argue about who was the greatest among them. In chapter 10, we read that again, Jesus tells them about his death that is approaching. James and John completely change the subject. Instead they ask, or sometimes it's reported their mother asks, for the places of honor when his kingdom comes. On each and every occasion when Jesus talks about his impending suffering and death, he calls the 12 to authentic discipleship. Discipleship that involves humility, service, suffering. And at every occasion, sharing about his death to the 12, they say, "No takami." Like the 12, we might think that such talk of the suffering nature of the Messiah and in turn discipleship, that it's optional. We too might want to talk Jesus out of it. But verse 31, however, reads that the Son of Man would suffer many terrible things. Actually, that word "would" is not actually accurate. The literal translation of the word is better "must." Jesus must suffer and die. It's also critical to understand that Jesus' discussion of his impending death and suffering is not metaphorical. Verse 32 in this passage states that Jesus talked about this openly with his disciples. He was clear, he was precise, he was blunt. But there's more to come. In verse 34, Jesus calls his disciples, and then he calls over the crowd. That's important. He calls them over to listen. The conditions for following him are not just for the 12 disciples. They are relevant for anyone who wants to follow Jesus. The call to selflessness and cross-bearing is not just for church leaders. It's for all believers. Those that follow Jesus, no matter who they are not to be just simple observers of Christ's passion. Instead, we grow in faith and understanding and to participate in Christ's suffering. Only when we follow the way of the cross will we really understand who Jesus really is. Jesus stipulated that those who wish to follow him must be prepared to shift the gravity of their lives from concern to self to reckless abandonment to the will of God. We are to say no to self, yes to God. This demand of Jesus is reinforced by his image of what we might call a death march. A death march that we are all on. Bearing the cross was not a Jewish metaphor that was in common usage in Jesus' day. Nor was the cross some sort of idiom that they liked to use. Instead, to his audience, the suggestion of picking up a cross and intentionally marching to one's death would sound absolutely vulgar, offensive. Crucifixions were so common during Jesus' day that the crowd would have no problem at all picturing one. It's just a picture they didn't want in their minds. This is especially true when the picture is intended to reflect back on the listener themselves. The words of Jesus raise a picture in the mind of a condemned person being forced to carry their instrument of their own execution on their back. The image is a somber reminder that if we are committed to following Jesus, there's no turning back. And if necessary, it means a willingness to go to the cross. In other words, and we don't want to hear it, Christ's followers must be willing to die. Not even our valuable lives are to have any allegiance above God and Christ. Now, Jesus is fully aware of the frailty of life, especially a life that is threatened by death. But he warns that anyone who seeks to preserve their own life at the expense of loyalty to Jesus brings on an even greater danger. And Jesus goes on to use the language of commerce here to drive the point home. He talks about profit and gain and loss and exchange. His point is that when you do commerce, you've got to find a common value to do business. The easiest way to think about that is with a currency exchange, correct? For people to buy and sell items in another country, they must have currency values that are representative of each other. For example, one Canadian dollar might be worth 78 cents, if we're lucky, American. Jesus' point, though, is that you cannot find anything in your earthly life to compare to the eternal value that he's offering us. The psalmist wrote, "They trust in their wealth and boast of great riches, yet they cannot redeem themselves from death by paying a ransom to God. Redemption does not come so easily, for no one can ever pay enough to live forever and never see the grave." It is utter foolishness to think that by securing one's own life here on earth, one can assure their salvation that is provided by God. Verse 38 reveals that almost all denial of Christ is based on a shame born out of our anxiety for our own lives and a refusal to be the object of contempt for those who ridicule Christ and his followers. In other words, we value comfort and social status and even our physical safety above loyalty to Jesus. Many years ago, the evangelist J. Edwin Orr was speaking at a university. And during the question and answer period, a young woman got up and asked this question. "Isn't it enough just to believe in Jesus? Isn't that what Christianity is all about? Simply believing?" Dr. Orr answered with a question of his own. "Do you believe in marriage?" "Oh, yes," the woman replied quickly. "Why do you believe in marriage?" Well, the woman said, "Because it creates a stable relationship that provides security for the partners, and it's a good arrangement in which to raise children. It helps bolster the stability of society." That was her answer. "Good," said Dr. Orr. "I'm a minister of the gospel, so allow me to pronounce you married." And the young woman laughed and said, "But I haven't found a man who will give himself to me and I can give myself to, or he can give himself to me. I haven't got a partner with whom I can make a life." "Exactly," said Dr. Orr. "It isn't enough to believe in marriage. You have to make a commitment and you have to live out your promise to care for your partner and do all the things that love requires." Making a lifelong commitment to live for Christ is at the very core of our being Christian. Simply believing the truth of the gospel, as important as that is, it just isn't enough. Maybe it's time for us to loosen our grip on our lives. To begin to let the eternal nature of Christ's promises begin to make a difference in our lives. Do you want to find true life? You won't find it by gaining the whole world and sacrificing your soul. You won't. You'll only find it if you take up your cross and you begin making your journey to Calvary, slowly dying to self as you go.